This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Caney. Coming up later in today's show, People Working Cooperatively, the nonprofit group that helps homeowners is celebrating its 40th year. Joining me now in the studio is Dr. Kathleen Smythe, who teaches African history, global economic development, and sustainability at Xavier University. Her latest book, Africa's Past, Our Future, engages the history of the African continent through the perspective of global issues such as political instability, economic development, and climate change. The book promotes an appreciation for African social, economic, and political systems that have endured over the long term and that offer different ways of thinking about our collective sustainable future. You can join the conversation at 513-419-7100, email talk at wvxu.org, or find us on Facebook or Twitter. And Kathleen, good to see you this afternoon. Thanks for being here.
Thank you, Mark. It's a pleasure to be here.
What led you to write this book?
I started writing this book really as I started teaching at Xavier University, and we teach a year-long history survey in many regions of the world. But sitting in Cincinnati, Ohio, and trying to make sense of African history, first for my students and then after a while for myself, I realized that what I was doing was connecting Africa's past to the way I live my life and the way I think about my life. And I started to just do that more consciously as a teacher, and then realized that the materials I wanted to use in class were not available. And so I started writing them myself.
What kind of response do you get from your students at Xavier who take African history? Is this an eye-opener for them? Do they say, wow, I never realized all this?
Yes, that's exactly what they say. The contrast between the images that they come in with, which tend to be the more popular images that our media portrays of hungry Africans or ethnic conflict or religious conflict, a continent that's dark, to use an overused metaphor, those images then contrast with the material in the book and the material that I try to get across in class. And so almost every day is an aha moment. Oh, there is a different way to look at this. There is more information out there. There are other perspectives.
And that's what you wanted to get across with the book as well.
It is exactly what I wanted to get across.
Now, what kind of research went into writing Africa's Past, Our Future?
A lot of reading. Historians generally do a lot of primary document research, but in order to do that, one has to travel to the continent. And I have a family and children who have been dragged to the continent multiple times. And at one point, they said, "That's enough, Mom." And so I used this part of my life as an opportunity to draw on secondary reading material and the books that others have written and the research that others have done, the primary research. And I love reading very widely across disciplines. And so it allowed me to learn a little bit more about geography, a little bit more about climate change, a little bit more about genetics, a little bit more about economics. And it was 6 or 7 years worth of reading and writing and teaching about it.
And this is your second book, correct?
It is.
What was the first one?
The first one looked at an ethnic group in Tanzania and the way in which their lives had been shaped by a group of Catholic missionaries called the White Fathers.
Okay. And did that have a lot of influence on the direction you took with this latest book?
You know, it's funny. As I was writing the conclusion to that book, I had the beginnings of this one in my mind. And yes, to the extent that story about mission contact and the way in which a group of Africans and a group of missionaries made sense of each other, that's a story of globalization. That's a story of how two different sets of ideas are not always in conflict, because the point of that book was they found common ground. And that this book, Africa's Past, Our Future, really seeks to lift up what Africans have done in the past, the ways they've lived, and how that story can contribute to our global future.
How much of Africa have you traveled to, Kathleen? How many countries have you seen there?
I have spent some time in Cameroon, West Africa. I've taken students from Xavier to Ghana in West Africa twice for a semester. And I taught in Kenya for a year as a volunteer teacher. And then I've done field work in Tanzania off and on for a number of years, probably cumulatively about 2.5 years.
What did the students you took to, it was Ghana, you said?
Yes.
What did they think of that trip?
Oh, it was a fantastic experience for me to be able to lead students to the continent and to watch them wrestle with the challenges and the privileges and the opportunities of learning across culture and being in a place that gets so little attention, particularly so little positive attention. Their lives were transformed, and it is such a gift to get to know students in that way. Xavier is all about holistic education. It becomes that much more holistic when they are across the ocean and having to learn a different language, navigate a different culture, and start to make sense of the impact that their lives, their country, has on another country, another group of people very far away.
I'm talking with Dr. Kathleen Smythe, who teaches African history, global economic development, and sustainability at Xavier University, and her new book is Africa's Past, Our Future. You can join the conversation 513-419-7100. You can email talk at wvxu.org, or you can find us on Facebook or Twitter. And Kathleen, what is it about Africa that makes it a model to look to for our future?
In the book, I note a number of reasons that I think that African history deserves far more attention than it has gotten, particularly as we think about crafting a different, more sustainable future. One of those is that it has the longest history of any place in the world because human beings developed there.
Birthplace of humanity.
Exactly. Yeah. And so you can start 7 or 8 million years ago with what we think right now was the first species that looked a little bit like humans. And once you introduce students to that long time frame, it really changes everything. Instead of starting with Greek or Roman history, which is pretty far back, but that's 2,000 years. Now we're talking millennia. There's a sense in which we owe a lot to ancestors from very, very long ago. And it, for me, and I think for my students, it evokes a humility. It evokes a humbleness that I think is very important. Our technological power and our educational knowledge and our wealth has made us very full of hubris. And I think part of education, the goal of education, is to remind us of our place in the larger scheme of things. So African history does that very nicely because of the long span that it covers. It also offers a chance to learn history from a very different perspective because we don't have many written documents from the continent. When we think about history, we think about our archives and letters and the paper trail that people have left in the past. But the written documents from Africa generally don't start until 100 years ago or so. So if you want to know about African history 2,000 years ago, then you have to turn to historical linguistics, which takes modern day languages and traces them back and lifts up key ideas from thousands of years ago, or archaeology. And in both cases, scholars who work with these sources call them more democratic often than written documents because they demonstrate to us how common people lived, the ways in which they made a living, the institutions they belonged to, the ideas that they had. It's a way of seeing a society more holistic than written documents tends to show us in many cases.
Now, are you saying that Africa gives us a perfect model to learn from? Or are you saying that we can also learn from the trials and errors and all the bad things that Africa has gone through as well?
Oh, definitely. It's a mixed bag. There, the reason I think that we need to pay more attention to Africa is because it's gotten so little attention, but it is by no means better continent, a better group of people, and they've had the same challenges and misfortunes that other peoples and other cultures have had. But their stories have not been told very often.
Mm-hmm. It's all relevant. You can learn from all of this, right? Just
exactly.
Like you can from any history.
Exactly.
Yeah. But Africa, as you're saying, it goes back a long, long time. So there's a treasure trove of history here, isn't there?
There is. There's a treasure trove of history. And because of the way in which we have to do the history, we uncover different ideas because we're forced to ask different questions. We're forced to look at data differently. So one of the ideas that I talk about in the book is heterarchy, which is in opposition to hierarchy. So the way many Western societies are structured, and our own is currently, if you think about our government system, it's vertical, and power and authority accumulate the higher up you go on that ladder. In a heterarchical society, authority is diffuse. And so many people can have many facets of power and authority. And if you start to look for it, you see it here too. We have church organizations, we have school organizations that do wield power and authority. But in African history, there are many societies that for a very long time had nothing but this kind of diffuse authority that cut across ethnic groups, that cut across peoples within one ethnic group.
So is that saying that in Africa, it's more acceptable to operate for the benefit of a collective group or to operate collectively as opposed to in the U.S. where we're more individualistic?
That cultural difference that you're highlighting is certainly one aspect of it. It's hard to say which is the chicken and which is the egg. But we know from our study of African history that the small numbers of people, the large landscape, all contributed for millennia, contributed to a very different way of organizing societies. And one way of organizing them, particularly if you are vulnerable to ecological change, which most Africans and most peoples in the past were, was to spread out the risk, to spread out the authority. And this is one strategy that that Africans used, even within societies that look to us like hierarchical societies. So one of the examples I used in the book is the Kingdom of Buganda, for which the modern day country of Uganda is named. And within that kingdom, you could see heterarchy at work and checking the power of the king of Buganda.
How diverse a country or how diverse a continent is Africa?
The easiest way to begin to describe the diversity is that there are more than 1,200 languages spoken on the continent. So you can imagine the United States has one formal language that we expect everybody to learn. There are many countries that have multiple national languages. So Kenya, where I first lived and worked, has two national languages, English and Kiswahili. English is the colonial language. Kiswahili is a trade language that developed out of the 1800s. And then underneath that are literally dozens of languages that are spoken on a smaller, more local scale.
How has Africa done at managing all this diversity?
I think that it depends on what you're looking at. Of course, in our media, what we often hear is the conflict between diverse ethnic groups. But there are many examples of countries like Tanzania, which lies just to the south of Kenya, that have tremendous diversity, that have managed it very well. Having a African language spoken at the national level like Kiswahili that Tanzania does helps because people can travel and they still can talk to each other. But it matters a lot how resources within the country are distributed and how political power is wielded. And it also matters what the history has been like for the last 150 or 200 years.
We'll continue our conversation about Africa's past, our future, and you can join us at 513-419-7100. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Haney. My guest this afternoon, Dr. Kathleen Smythe, who teaches African history, global economic development, and sustainability at Xavier University. Her latest book is Africa's Past, Our Future. You can join us at 513-419-7100, email talk at wvxu.org, or find us on Facebook or Twitter. And Kathleen, there's a Nigerian proverb in the introduction to the book. In the moment of crisis, the wise build bridges and the foolish build dams. Why did you include that in there? What's the message you want people to get from that? That's an interesting proverb.
Yes, the message for me, at least, is that we need to build bridges to the histories and cultures of all peoples in the world. In the United States, we are the inheritors of a very rich tradition that has a tremendous amount going for it. But if we see that we need to make changes in the future, then we would be wise to look to other places and other peoples for the ways in which they've navigated difficult times, difficult landscapes. And Africans' ideas and institutions that have lasted over a very long duration are part of the wealth that we have available to us as a common humanity.
You know, talking about navigating difficulties, climate change, changes in the environment, global warming, they have a lot of experience in this area, don't they?
Yes, yes. One of the areas that I look at is what is known as the Sahel, which lies just south of the Sahara Desert. And what researchers have found there is that the climate there has changed dramatically over time and rapidly, so that they talk about green states of the Sahel and then desert states, so green and dry states. And 5,000 years ago was the end of the last green state, and since then we've been in a drier desert state of the Sahel. And there have been many implications of that change, but one of them, which many people aren't aware of, is that ancient Egypt grew out of that climate change. Before that climate change, there were many people living across what is now the Sahel and the Sahara, and it was more like a grassland. As the rains declined, people had to make a choice. They had to move so that they could continue to live in a similar way, or they had to stay where they are and figure out a different way of making a living. And many moved to the Nile River Valley because they could continue to live in much the same way and take advantage of the river and its resources. And eventually, starting about 3500 BCE, the kingdoms of ancient Egypt arose. And so the pyramids, the pharaohs, everything we associate, the writing, the technology, the scientific aspects of the ancient kingdom, in many ways are due to significant, dramatic climate change.
Only in the case of Africa, it hasn't been so much warming as it has been getting drier. Is that correct?
You can see multiple trends. That's one example. But certainly, even contemporarily, most Africans, particularly in East Africa, have been experiencing climate change for the last 20 or 30 years, and it has been, it appears as a drying. What's happening is that the rainfall is shifting, and so it's raining over the ocean instead of raining where their crops have been growing. So again, I think we in the United States are adjusting to the new reality of climate change, but Africans have been adjusting in many places for decades and probably have much to teach us about those adjustments.
When it comes to forms of social organization, you say in the book that Africa is one of the best places in the world to study matrilineary. Am I saying that correctly?
You are saying it correctly, yes.
What is matrilineary? Why is it so important to understand its history?
In human history, there have been two or three ways of organizing societies, and particularly inheritance. Matrilineary is one of them. Patrilineary, which we have now in the United States, is another. And then some societies would recognize inheritance through both lines, and that would be bilateral kinship. In African history, early African history, thousands of years ago, probably half of Africans at least practiced matrilineary. And it's often confused with matriarchy.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not matriarchy. It doesn't mean woohoo, women rule. What it means is that in addition to inheritance passing through the mother's line, women tend to have more freedom, economic and political freedom and rights, but it still does involve men. And so a woman's brother would have as much interest in and control over her children as he would, more so than he would his own, because it's the mother's line that's important, not the father's line. And the ramifications that that has for a society are very broad. One example is that siblings then would be closer probably than married partners. And so from our perspective, it means a looser marriage. From the African perspective, particularly in the distant past when humans were still populating the continent and trying to eke out an existence in a very difficult environment, it meant the survival of their children would probably be stronger if they emphasized the sibling relationship rather than a married relationship. But it also has economic implications because the uncle has an interest in the children, the mother has an interest in the children, the father has an interest in the children. And so all of those adults are working to secure resources and to make sure that the children live and prosper. In a patrilineal society, the accumulation tends to stay within the nuclear family and is narrower. And so a lot of scholars look at matrilineal as perhaps a more distributive economic system. It's also more hierarchical, to go back to a term we were using earlier. It spreads authority.
513-419-7100 to join the conversation. And let's talk with Seydou in Cincinnati. Did I say that correctly, Seydou?
Yes, that is correct.
Okay. Well, good afternoon to you.
Good afternoon. I would like to thank the doctor for writing. And my comment is about the observation she made earlier about the history of Africa not being studied enough. And I think that that observation is also true for Africans. For example, in many countries, like the one I came from in the Sahel, by the way, the history isn't studied enough. One example I can think of is the valley of the Senegal River. There was a revolution a few hundred years ago that almost mirrored the American Revolution in terms of constitution and democracy principles. And interestingly, that revolution occurred in 1776. I've only learned of that recently. I did not learn of it when I was in school in Africa. So it's just that same point applies to Africans themselves. They don't study the history enough. And I look forward to reading the doctor.
Thank you, Seydou. We appreciate it.
It's a great point. And I think part of the reason I wrote the book was to encourage others to be more outspoken about what we have to learn from Africa. There is a rich tradition and history on the continent.
Yeah, that's a good point, too. Is the history of Africa studied heavily in Africa, or just how hard would that be when you don't have too many written documents going back too far in time?
It is being studied. Obviously, Africans are interested in their own history because of the unequal distribution of resources across the globe. The concentration of the study of the history of Africa is unfortunately still outside of the continent. But there has been the field of African history really was born in the 1960s with the end of colonization and the independence of many African countries. And African scholars have made enormous contributions to the field of African history. But there are definitely some fields that are still very challenging. And archaeology is one of them because it is so labor and research intensive. And the continent is massive. So one of the things I tell my students all the time, particularly about human evolution, is just follow this story. Because almost with every find, we change ideas about what happened in the past, about where we came from, who we are. It's a fascinating field to study, and it is one of those that could use far more resources and far more personnel invested in it.
What perspective can Africa's past economics give us today?
The past, there are a number of ideas, including matrilineal, including heterarchy. One of the ideas that I lift up in my book that's more contemporary that I think is terribly important is the role of the informal economy. And obviously that's contrasted with the formal economy, which most of the listeners are probably engaged in, which is a job that's registered, a wage that's reported to the government.
A checking account, a savings account.
And a way for the government to monitor this economic activity. Mm-hmm. So when we look at nations globally, we often use gross domestic product as a measure. And those kinds of jobs and those kinds of wages are incorporated into that measure. But anybody who has traveled to a country in the South has seen the informal economy at play. It's the street hawkers selling eggs and soap and matches and gum, and you can buy almost anything on the street in many places. And when a country is relying on the informal economy for the vast majority of its economic support, that's a sign that things are changing and that we need to pay attention. Instead, unfortunately, most of the time, we don't pay attention and we label it the informal economy. We push it to the side and it doesn't count in GDP. And therefore, it's very easy to slip into the people who are engaged in it do not count. And so it's the informal economy is one of those wake up calls to all of us to say, how did it get to this point? And should we be thinking about this as part of our global economy and taking it into consideration as we make decisions rather than pushing it off to the side and hoping, pretending perhaps that it doesn't exist?
What country or countries do you consider to be African success stories?
There are a good number of them. One of the countries that I cover in the book, because it's one of those aha moments for everyone, including me, is the fact that within the story of Somalia is the story of Somaliland, which is a portion of Greater Somalia. And it has very little piracy. It has a functioning government and has had for 20 years. And it exists in the midst of a fair amount of turmoil on its borders as an example of what people can do when they hold on to ideas that they've had for thousands of years, because they've built this state on their pastoral societies and institutions that have maintained these livestock keeping societies. And they've added to it modern notions of government, legislature, president, a justice system. And the combination has served them very, very well over the last 20 years in a region that most listeners would think is a very unstable region.
Right. You think of piracy, you think of all these failed attempts at becoming a nation state. So it's rather surprising
exactly,
to hear that.
Exactly. And one of the reasons we don't hear about it is because of our own, is because of geopolitical issues, that to recognize Somaliland, which it has not been recognized by the international community, is to jeopardize the chances of a united Somalia at some point in the future. And so there are tensions there. But for the people in Somaliland, it's been a tremendous success.
So what's your next project, the next manuscript that you're working on right now?
I actually am working on a book that looks at the way in which the Anthropocene, which is the term that's now being considered for our new geological era, to say that when people look at the geological record far in the future, they're going to see the impact that humans have made on the environment. Look at what that means for humanity, and using this idea of long history that I've used in this book to examine what it means to be human, particularly at the interface of human societies and their dependence on interaction with, union with the environment.
Kathleen, thanks for talking with us this afternoon.
Thank you very much.
Dr. Kathleen Smythe, who teaches African history, global economic development, and sustainability at Xavier University. Her new book is Africa's Past, Our Future. Coming up, People Working Cooperatively celebrates its 40th birthday. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU.